Welcome back to Breast Cancer Update. At the recent ASCO meeting in Atlanta, the initial results of NSABP-P2, where the STAR trial, were presented, and of great interest, the SERM raloxifene demonstrated some toxicity advantages over tamoxifen in this trial of postmenopausal women. I met with the protocol chairman of the STAR trial, Dr. Victor Vogel, to review these results, but to begin our conversation, I queried him about another important recent data set from the NSABP, the Oncotype DX assay.
We all know that patients with ER-positive invasive breast cancer have a relatively good prognosis as a group, but we're also aware that there's a subset of those patients who are not going to do well and who would benefit from the addition of cytotoxic chemotherapy to their hormonal therapy, be it tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. Classical breast cancer prognostic factors like tumor size, grade, ER, and so forth have helped us a great deal in identifying patients who may benefit from the combination of hormonal and cytotoxic therapy. But it was clear to many experts in the field that the availability of a test to further discriminate groups who would benefit from the addition of cytotoxic therapy to hormonal therapy from those who would need only hormonal therapy would be an important advance. With that as background, the NSABP undertook a partnership with Genomic Health Incorporated, and using the very fine scientific background work of Soon Paik and his molecular pathology lab at NSABP, sought to determine if they could identify a small set of genes that could be identified in paraffin-embedded tissue that might identify those patients with a poor prognosis who could benefit from the addition of cytotoxic therapy to hormonal therapy. And so they did some pilot studies with archival tissue from NSABP breast cancer patients, and they looked to see if they could come up with a small set of genes that could distinguish those patients prognostically and predictively in terms of which ones might benefit from therapy. And we had available to us several trials within the NSABP where patients had received either hormonal therapy alone or hormonal therapy plus chemotherapy, notably the B20 trial. And then we had some trials where patients had hormonal therapy versus no hormonal therapy, for example, the B14 trial. And using the archival tissue blocks from those trials, Genomic Health and Dr. Paik were able to start with a reasonable set of, say, 200 genes that were reported in the literature to possibly be related to outcome in breast cancer. And they narrowed that set of genes down to just 16 genes that could be sorted into logical groups related to the estrogen receptor, the HER2 protein, proliferation and invasion characteristics of the cells. And they used that set of 16 genes plus 5 reference genes to see whether they could sort breast cancer patients into prognostic and predictive groups. And when I say prognostic groups, I mean predict the likelihood of recurrence. And when I say predictive groups, I mean could they identify patients who were in fact benefiting from chemotherapy compared to those who were deriving no benefit. So they looked at these archival subsets, and they were able in fact to determine that those 16 genes along with 5 reference genes could sort patients along a continuum that they called the recurrence score, and that score varies from 0 to 100. And that recurrence score could then be translated using simple mathematical regression procedures into a probability of recurrence over 10 years. And what they were able to determine was that patients who had low recurrence scores, that is scores of 18 or lower, benefited from hormonal therapy, but derived no additional benefit from the addition of chemotherapy to their hormonal therapy regimens. Conversely, in patients with high recurrence scores, scores of 31 or higher, there was a clear, statistically significant, and large benefit from adding cytotoxic chemotherapy to hormonal therapy, that is tamoxifen. And in the intermediate group, the group with scores between 18 and 30, there was no apparent benefit from the addition of chemotherapy, but the confidence intervals, the statistical certainty of no benefit, was not established. So what came out of that was the Oncotype DX assay from Genomic Health that is commercially available and allows essentially selection of patients for hormonal therapy alone or hormonal therapy plus chemotherapy in the high-risk group. In the intermediate risk group, we're left with some uncertainty, but there's an intergroup clinical trial known as the TAILOR-RX study, which for patients who have ER-positive, node-negative, early stage, stage 1, small stage 2 breast cancers, can enter the TAILOR-RX trial and be randomly assigned to chemotherapy or no chemotherapy in addition to their hormonal therapy if they fall into that intermediate risk group.
And I guess for practical purposes, the low recurrence score patients are about half of the total, the intermediate about a quarter, and the high about a quarter. Is that your take?
That's my recollection. And I think that would also reflect our recent clinical experience within the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute and McGee Women's Hospital, where we've used this test nearly 200 times in the last year or so. And our oncologists like it a lot. The surgeons have recognized its importance, and certainly the patients do. And I see the benefit to patients working in both ways. That is, when we get high recurrence scores, my impression is that patients are reassured and gratified to know that, in fact, they will derive additional benefit from getting cytotoxic chemotherapy. And not surprisingly, the patients in the low risk group are delighted that they do not require cytotoxic chemotherapy. I was a little bit concerned that there might be anxiety in the intermediate risk group with doubts about what to do, but we show those patients the data, express the uncertainty, and some of them elect to have chemotherapy and some of them do not. And now that the TAILOR-RX trial is open, our plan will be to encourage most of them to enter the trial.
You know, it's interesting. There have been a lot of discussions recently about the effect of chemotherapy in women with ER-positive tumors, and a number of studies that have come out suggesting, well, we've known for a long time that it's a lot less than in patients with ER-negative tumors. And yet, using this assay in the high recurrence score patients who do have ER-positive tumors, the relative risk reduction, I think, was around 75%, which is quite substantial.
Yes, for those patients who are in the high recurrence score group, even though they're ER-positive and derive substantial benefit from hormonal therapy, they will derive large additional therapeutic benefit from the cytotoxics. And I think that perhaps is not completely consonant with what we thought we knew about ER-positive disease. Although, if you look at the large meta-analysis, we knew that even in patients with relatively good prognosis, ER-positive disease, certainly a number of those women reoccurred. And I think when you look at it in that regard, then this data with Oncotype DX and the addition of cytotoxic chemotherapy does make sense.
Now, it's interesting that these research data have come out, you know, a little bit before the time that we found out that adjuvant trastuzumab works so well. At this point in time, to what extent, if any, do you think the Oncotype is useful in patients with HER2-positive tumors?
You know, that's a very interesting question because, again, some of the data that's emerging from the Oncotype DX data is perhaps counterintuitive. That is, it is possible, and we can all cite examples of patients who were HER2-positive and were incorporated into the data set to have Oncotype DX, and yet their recurrence score was not necessarily in the high-risk group. That is, the presence of HER2 doesn't by itself trump all the other genomic prognostic factors. And I think that was a revelation to some of us because many of us had argued that, well, we know that the presence of the HER2 protein stratifies subsets, and all the subsets looked at appear to have a worse prognosis for patients with HER2 overexpression than those that are negative. And yet, when you do the assay on ER-positive tumors, the presence of HER2 does not necessarily put the patient into a high-risk group. So what I'm saying is that the presence of HER2 should not lead one to not perform an Oncotype DX assay because the result may be a surprise and the patient may, in fact, still have a low result and not require chemotherapy. Now, I think the question that remains unanswered by the available data is whether those patients who are HER2 overexpressers and are going to get hormonal therapy alone, should we be thinking about Herceptin for those patients? And currently we don't have an answer to that question, but I believe there are trials that are envisioned to answer that question.
I mean, my understanding was that it's very, very uncommon to have a low recurrence score in HER2-positive tumor.
It is uncommon, but I have seen it occur.
Are there any patients in your practice that you might be able to present in a de-identified way that sort of help make the point of how the oncotype works clinically?
Yes, I can. So I can remember a patient about a year and a half ago who was in her late 50s. She had a 1.2 centimeter ER positive, node negative breast cancer. It had a Nottingham score of 5, and for all the world looked like it had an excellent prognosis. She presented to our clinic at about the time we were beginning to use Oncotype DX, and before there was certainty about payment by her third-party payer, but she and I and her husband discussed the potential value of doing Oncotype DX, and they agreed that we should get the information. And lo and behold, when the result came back, her recurrence score was, if I remember correctly, 36, and she was clearly a candidate for cytotoxic chemotherapy, and she was a bit disgruntled by the result, but recognized that the result was telling us that she would derive significant benefit from chemotherapy, and she got 4 cycles of adriamycin and cyclophosphamide, did well, and at the end of the day, 6 months later, was quite happy that she had elected to receive the chemotherapy.
That's interesting. I find a lot of patients, you know, have heard about chemotherapy and have great concerns about chemotherapy. What was she expecting from the chemotherapy, and how did that compare to what actually happened?
Well, my experience has been like yours. There's a large number of urban legends out there. The internet has probably promulgated some of those legends. And she believed that her quality of life was going to be terrible with cytotoxic chemotherapy, that she was going to be nauseated, fatigued, unable to carry out her job. She was a school bus driver and was very concerned about continuing her work as a school bus driver. And I assured her that in my experience that those kind of disabling symptoms, while possible, were rare. And fortunately, her experience was that. Of course, she had the alopecia, but she had very little fatigue, very little nausea, and she found the 4 cycles to be tolerable and was able to continue with her work.
So was she able to work during the chemotherapy?
Well, she actually elected to stop during the chemotherapy, and I believe the timing was such that she was diagnosed in the spring, and so most of her chemotherapy occurred in the summertime when she wasn't driving anyway. But by the time the fall came, she resumed her activities, and it was not necessary for her to curtail most of her usual activities during the time that she got her chemotherapy. But I think the decision to take the chemotherapy was clearly facilitated by the data from the Oncotype DX result. And had that not been available, I think she would have been very, very reluctant to undertake the additional therapy.
Any patients that sort of make the opposite point, patients who were able to avoid chemotherapy?
Yes, I can remember a 62-year-old woman with a 1.8 centimeter tumor who we were virtually certain was going to come back with a high recurrence score, and she was somewhat resigned to the fact that she was probably going to need chemotherapy, and her recurrence score came back as 16, if I remember. And we told her that the data would suggest that she would not derive benefit from receiving the chemotherapy, and she was both surprised and delighted that that was our recommendation.
What type of hormonal therapy did she get?
She got anastrozole, an aromatase inhibitor. And I do tell the patients that the data we have related to the performance of the recurrence score with Oncotype DX is essentially derived from tamoxifen-treated patients. So there is some limitation in the generalizability of our knowledge about the performance of aromatase inhibitors with this assay. Again, there will be data in that regard very soon, but I have no reason to think that the test will not perform with equal predictability for patients who are treated with an aromatase inhibitor instead of tamoxifen.
Now, you mentioned that you were thinking that she was going to come back with a high recurrence score. Of course, she's starting out with a not tiny tumor at 1.8 centimeters. What were the other factors that had you concerned?
If I remember correctly, she had a poor nuclear grade was the other factor. We actually have started to have a little contest with our clinical fellows, and we asked them to predict the recurrence score when they see the tumor characteristics, and we also make our own predictions. And we've taught ourselves in just a very few cases that it is virtually impossible to predict the recurrence score, with, as you said, the exception of perhaps the HER2 overexpressors. But for most of the tumors, we've found that we've had a very, very difficult time predicting what the recurrence scores will be based on the classical tumor characteristics of size, grade, and so forth, or the degree of hormone receptor positivity. When we see those patients who have 80% 3+ ER positivity on their immunohistochemistry compared to those that have, say, only a 40% 3+ positivity, we can't see any correlation between the degree of estrogen receptor, except at the very, very far extremes, and the recurrence score. One area we have had a little difficulty is sometimes if the tumors are too small, half a centimeter, 7 millimeters, we sometimes, 2 or 3 times, have been unable to identify sufficient tumor on the block to be able to get a result. When that happens, we discuss the situation with the patient, but my experience has been that most of those patients elect, in fact, not to have chemotherapy with those very small sub-centimeter tumors.
Assuming that there is adequate tissue, how do you factor in size? You know, you talked about a sub-centimeter tumor. What about a 3 to 4 centimeter tumor? Does that sort of shade your view?
We've had a number of discussions in our group about size and the willingness to perform Oncotype DX assays on larger tumors. And I think for all the oncologists in our group, there's some number above 2 centimeters where they begin to develop a little bit of unease about doing Oncotype DX. And whether it's at 2 centimeters or 2.5 centimeters, I think for almost all of us, by the time we get to 3 centimeters, we're not completely comfortable with talking about not doing chemotherapy. And I don't recall exactly, but if my recollection serves me, the range of tumor sizes in the data that was published about Oncotype DX didn't go much beyond tumors in the mid-2-centimeter range. And so I think we need more data there to see whether or not we can reliably omit chemotherapy in the larger T2 tumors, where I think most oncologists are uncomfortable about omitting it at this point.
You mentioned that this second patient received anastrozole. How did she do on the anastrozole? Any symptoms?
She did not have symptoms, but we are seeing a relatively large proportion, that is between 15 and 20% of our patients who receive anastrozole for adjuvant therapy, that they are experiencing arthralgias and myalgias, and some of them so severely that we need to discontinue the aromatase inhibitor. That appears to be occurring in about 2 to 5% of patients where we have to discontinue, but I think as many as 1 in 5 patients report significant myalgias or arthralgias. Now, we've approached that with either temporarily discontinuing therapy, giving them 2 to 4 weeks off the aromatase inhibitor, and then restarting it. My impression is that a large number of those patients with a break in therapy and then restarting can resume their treatment, but there are some who cannot, and then we switch them to another agent. So if they started with anastrozole, the switch is typically to letrozole, and very often that switch will resolve the problem. In my discussions with other oncologists around the country, though, they've not had great success in switching aromatase inhibitors, and they report that many of their patients who have arthralgias, myalgias with one will have them with another. I can only remember 2 patients in the last 3 or 4 years who we've had to abandon aromatase inhibitor therapy and go to tamoxifen because they simply couldn't tolerate any of the 3 aromatase inhibitors.
What's your experience been in terms of overall quality of life, side effects, et cetera? You mentioned the arthralgia, tamoxifen versus the AIs.
Well, I've been surprised at the relative paucity of symptoms in these patients. I would have predicted that when you reduce the circulating ligand by over 95%, that most of these postmenopausal women would have been very symptomatic, that they would have had hot flashes, mood swings, sleep disturbances, all sorts of daily symptoms that would be problematic and difficult, and I haven't seen that, somewhat to my surprise. That other than the arthralgias and myalgias, we have seen very, very few symptomatic side effects.
How would you contrast the more serious complications from aromatase inhibitors versus tamoxifen? There was some data presented at the ASCO meeting on bone. Where are we right now with bone fractures versus problems with tamoxifen?
One of the things that we tell people initially when we tell them that we're choosing aromatase inhibitor therapy and not tamoxifen, and many patients are aware of tamoxifen, they expect sometimes to receive tamoxifen and we offer them an aromatase inhibitor, we tell them at the initiation of therapy that compared to tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors have really a better safety profile. There's fewer thromboembolic events, there are certainly fewer uterine events, and there is the issue of the bones. But we begin by saying, in general, the aromatase inhibitors in postmenopausal women compared to tamoxifen are better, safer drugs. Then we turn our attention to both the myalgias and arthralgias, which we mentioned so that patients are aware of them when we start their therapy. And then we talk very specifically about the bone data. My impression of the bone data from the completed reported adjuvant therapy trials is that while it was known that aromatase inhibitors could affect bone density and osteoporotic fractures, there was not in those adjuvant trials a systematic, repeated search for bone loss and an attempt to treat that loss with calcium and bisphosphonates. We tell all our patients that we believe they should have baseline DEXA scans. We tell them that our intention will be to repeat their DEXA scans every 24 months, which is the recommendation of our osteoporosis experts. And then if we see T-scores on the DEXA scans that are more severe than a -2, we initiate therapy with bisphosphonates. Now, our strategy has been to offer the oral bisphosphonate of choice. And we tell the patient that we can work that out with their primary care physician, or we can select with them one of the oral bisphosphonates. Or we also have been successful in about half the patients of getting their insurance payers to pay for IV bisphosphonates, that is zoledronate. And many patients like this because they don't have to then take a weekly or a daily oral bisphosphonate. They don't have to endure the GI side effects that occur with oral bisphosphonates. And where we can get it paid for, the IV bisphosphonate has been very well received by the patients. We also have some data from our practice with Adam Brufsky's ZFAST study showing that the initiation of zoledronic acid at the start of aromatase inhibitor therapy can actually prevent the bone loss that does occur with aromatase inhibitors. Now, the data are not mature enough yet to have data about fractures, but we certainly know that based on the DEXA scan data, the early initiation of bisphosphonate therapy at the time of initiation of aromatase inhibitors can prevent the bone loss. So for us, Neil, the bone issue is one we talk about, but it doesn't dissuade us from using aromatase inhibitors, even in our elderly population, 65 and older, who are probably the bulk of the users of the aromatase inhibitors.
When you do use IV bisphosphonates, zoledronate, how often do you use it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the exact answer for that is not yet in. There will be data available comparing 6-monthly to 12-monthly zoledronate. Our approach in these patients has been to use it every 6 months at this point, but we're awaiting the data to see whether every 12 months is sufficient.
How do you approach the patient? We're starting to see more and more of them who are coming up with having received 5 years of an adjuvant aromatase inhibitor.
That's a very challenging question. And up until the San Antonio meeting 8 months ago, I wasn't certain on what the answer was to that question. But I was very heartened by the data that was presented both by Paul Goss and Jim Engel on the continued follow-up of the MA17 patients, and particularly in the MA17 patients who had initially been assigned to placebo and then crossed over to letrozole. And two things were evident from those data. The first was that the longer you took letrozole following 5 years of tamoxifen, the larger was the benefit. And it is rare in medical oncology, as you know, to see a benefit that grows with duration of therapy. But it was clear that the longer the duration of therapy with letrozole, the larger was the benefit. And if you compared 2 years to 4 years, if I remember correctly, the benefit almost doubled. And so for our high-risk patients especially, those with larger tumors, those with positive nodes, Based on those data, we're now telling them that they really should continue to take their letrozole because we know they're at risk for a very long time, 2 decades or longer, for recurrence. And these data now show that longer therapy may actually improve their outcomes. And the other question that those data really helped us with was for patients who have a gap between the end of their tamoxifen therapy and the initiation of their aromatase inhibitor therapy. So the patients who were initially assigned to placebo after 5 years of tamoxifen in the MA17 trial crossed over to letrozole, and there were some 1,600 patients who made the crossover, and their average duration off therapy, that is the time between the end of their tamoxifen and the initiation of their letrozole, was about 30 months. And even with that gap, that delay in the initiation of the aromatase inhibitor, there was a demonstrated statistically significant benefit with a so-called delayed initiation of the aromatase inhibitor after tamoxifen. And shortly after I saw those data, I saw a 45-year-old nurse who worked in our institution who had come off her tamoxifen before the MA17 data were available. She had not initiated letrozole therapy. And when I saw her in follow-up visit, I said, you know, these data really suggest that we haven't missed an opportunity and that we should probably initiate letrozole therapy for you, because she had a 3.5-centimeter tumor that had a couple of positive nodes. And I thought then, based on those data, even with the gap, there would be a benefit for initiating the letrozole.
And I guess also with these new data, we're becoming more sensitive to the time course of recurrence, particularly of ER-positive tumors, and the frequency of relapse, you know, after 5, even 10 years.
It's a sobering reality that 5 years is not a magic number for breast cancer. And as I said a moment ago, it's really a 2-decade or 2.5-decade disease. And while the hazard rate, the risk of recurrence, is highest in the first 2 or 3 years or so, there's a constant risk of recurrence that persists from years 3 to 20. And while it's small, it is still present in patients with what we've always regarded as very good prognosis tumors, that is small ER-positive, node-negative tumors. But those women do still recur, and that's one of my favorite slides when I talk about the persistence of aromatase inhibitor therapy, that recurrences do occur late. They occur in good prognosis tumors, and I think it's a motivation to think about continuing therapy for a long time.
So I take it that when you see patients like the one you just described who come through the office who've had ER-positive tumors in the past, maybe they received tamoxifen or, you know, even no hormonal therapy, but if they have never received an AI, that you're going to be thinking about that, I guess looking at their risk of recurrence and considering it almost at any point?
Well, I think we have to be constrained by the data, but certainly we have data with an average delay of initiation of aromatase inhibitor therapy of 2.5 to 3 years. Whether I would do it past 5 years, I'm not sure. But if the patient was at significant risk, I think it would be something that would need to be considered, and it would have to be discussed, knowing that there aren't data to directly answer the question. But it's certainly the data that are available are suggestive that there may be benefit in those situations.
Now, of course, we know that you can't use aromatase inhibitors in actively menstruating premenopausal women. There's a lot of debate about what to do with women who stop menstruating on chemotherapy. But what about the premenopausal woman who receives her 5 years of tamoxifen, goes through menopause, now's a couple years later, she's having hot flashes, she's biochemically menopausal. Would you consider starting an AI in that situation?
I do consider that, and I am sobered, as all of us are, by the data suggesting that the absence of menses does not equate to menopause. But as you said, if you can demonstrate chemically that the patient is menopausal as well as having the absence of menses, then for patients who are premenopausal and now have transitioned to become postmenopausal, yes, we do recommend aromatase inhibitor therapy to follow their tamoxifen therapy if we're convinced that they're postmenopausal.
Now, I know the NSABP is either doing or considering a trial looking at durations of aromatase inhibitors beyond 5 years. Where is that right now?
That trial is under active discussion, and my understanding is that that trial should open shortly. And I think there will be great interest among clinicians, both oncologists and surgeons, to enroll patients in that trial. And my understanding is it should open in the very near future.
What about aromatase inhibitors and prevention? I want to ask you about the STAR trial in a minute, but just sort of taking a step back, the NSABP already has the B35 trial in DCIS, which, you know, kind of is a prevention type setting. And the STAR trial now obviously is closed. And I guess already in the United Kingdom, there's a anastrozole versus placebo primary prevention trial. How do you think aromatase inhibitors are going to stack up in the prevention setting?
I think we've all been very gratified in the adjuvant trials when we look at the incidence of second contralateral breast primary tumors in patients receiving tamoxifen compared to those receiving aromatase inhibitors. We know from 20 years of tamoxifen data that the reduction of the contralateral second primaries is about 50%. I believe the number was 47% in the Oxford overview. But it's now evident that with the aromatase inhibitors, compared to patients receiving tamoxifen, where we know the risk reduction is half, that there's an additional 20 or 30% reduction in the incidence of contralateral second tumors in those adjuvant trials where patients received an aromatase inhibitor. And this, plus preclinical data that shows that aromatase inhibitors very effectively prevent the emergence of invasive breast cancers in animal models, this has led to the emergence of two ongoing trials and a soon-to-be-started trial. The ongoing trials, as you mentioned, there's the IBIS-2 trial in the United Kingdom, which is anastrozole compared to placebo. There's a North American trial that compares exemestane to placebo, the so-called MAP3 study. And the NSABP is proposing a third aromatase inhibitor primary prevention trial, the so-called P4 trial, which will compare the winner, if you will, of the STAR trial, raloxifene, with letrozole. And the reason we selected letrozole was because it was the third aromatase inhibitor and was not in an ongoing primary prevention trial. So we will soon have primary prevention trials being conducted with all three aromatase inhibitors that are commercially available in the U.S. The difference with the NSABP trial will be comparison not to placebo, but to an active agent, raloxifene. We don't believe in the NSABP that primary risk reduction trials should be conducted compared to placebo, because we know that tamoxifen is substantially better than placebo from several published trials. And now that we have data showing that raloxifene is a better, safer drug than tamoxifen, we believe that the standard should be comparison of an aromatase inhibitor in postmenopausal women to raloxifene.
What about aromatase inhibitors in DCIS? The B35 trial is studying anastrozole versus tamoxifen. Do you think there's any role for an aromatase inhibitor in DCIS outside a protocol setting, for example, in a patient who you don't want to give tamoxifen to?
I just got that question this week from one of our community oncologists. He had a patient who was in her 60s with DCIS who had had thromboembolic events in the past. He was very reluctant to give her tamoxifen because of those prior clotting events, and he asked me whether I thought an aromatase inhibitor was appropriate there. And I said that in my opinion, in that situation, yes, it would be appropriate because there is an indication for hormonal therapy, and that was a situation where I could support using the AI. Outside of that situation where there's a clear contraindication, I don't think it's yet appropriate to prescribe AIs for postmenopausal patients with DCIS. Now, the B35 trial has, as you know, just finished accruing over 3,000 patients, and I'm hopeful that within a few years, we'll be able to see results. I'll go out on a limb and predict that there's no reason to believe the aromatase inhibitor won't be more effective, because every time we've compared an aromatase inhibitor to tamoxifen, whether it's in advanced disease or in the adjuvant setting, the aromatase inhibitor is always more effective. So I would predict that the aromatase inhibitor should be more effective than tamoxifen in the setting of DCIS, but we'll simply have to await the data.
It'll be interesting to see, too, how bone plays out in this sort of second generation of trials. You mentioned that the first generation attack, et cetera, really, we didn't know what to expect. There wasn't really no preemptive bone monitoring or bisphosphonate usage. I assume in these next generation of trials, there will be bone monitoring. What do you think we're going to see in terms of fractures?
I think the fracture risk will still be present, but I think it's not going to be nearly what we saw in either ATAC or Big 198, because I think when you are aware of it, pursue it, look for osteoporosis, and treat it. The fractures should not be near the problem they have been in the past.
Let's talk a little bit about the STAR trial. Can you kind of summarize what was seen?
In the STAR trial, we built upon the data that were available from the NSABP P1 trial, or the breast cancer prevention trial. And in that study, we had both pre- and postmenopausal women who were at increased risk of breast cancer. And there were 13,381 women in that trial, half of whom, approximately 6,700, received tamoxifen and half received placebo. And compared to placebo, tamoxifen reduced the incidence of invasive disease by 49% and in situ disease, that is DCIS, by about 50%. We also had data available from several prospective osteoporosis trials that were using raloxifene to treat mostly older postmenopausal women who were not at increased risk of breast cancer. But those trials, particularly the Moore trial, showed that the breast cancer risk reduction with raloxifene compared to placebo was substantial. It was in excess of 60%. There were also preclinical data to suggest that, like tamoxifen, raloxifene prevented the emergence of invasive tumors in rat chemically induced breast cancer models. So we began the STAR trial in July of 1999 through the NSABP sites. There were 200 main sites and 200 additional satellites. And we enrolled between 1999 and 2004, 19,747 high-risk postmenopausal patients. Half of them received tamoxifen, half of them received raloxifene, the dose of tamoxifen, 20 milligrams, and 60 milligrams a day of raloxifene. The trial was monitored by a data and safety monitoring committee who, in December of 2005, declared that the trial had reached its pre-stated number of invasive breast cancer events, 321, and so the trial was unblinded. At the time of the unblinding, the occurrence of invasive breast cancer incidence was essentially the same comparing tamoxifen to raloxifene. There were 163 invasive breast cancer cases in the tamoxifen arm, 168 in the raloxifene arm. So there was no statistically significant difference. But compared to the predicted number of invasive breast cancer events at the start of the trial using the Gale model, the risk reduction was about 50%. So that the effect of raloxifene was equal to that of tamoxifen, and the effect of tamoxifen in the STAR trial was about what we had seen in the first breast cancer prevention trial. Interestingly, and perhaps somewhat surprisingly, there was not as great of an effect by raloxifene on the incidence of non-invasive breast cancer, so that with tamoxifen, we saw 57 cases of in situ cancer, and that included both ductal carcinoma in situ and lobular carcinoma in situ, 57 cases with tamoxifen and 80 cases with raloxifene. Now, it was not statistically significant, but it did represent 40% more in situ cases with raloxifene than with tamoxifen. However, on the other side, there was a larger safety profile with raloxifene, and that is we saw about a 38% reduction in the incidence of invasive uterine cancer comparing raloxifene to tamoxifen, with only 23 uterine events, invasive uterine events with raloxifene compared to 36 with tamoxifen. And there was a 50% reduction in the number of patients who required hysterectomy with raloxifene compared to tamoxifen. So overall, there were far, far fewer uterine events with raloxifene compared to tamoxifen. Another major benefit that we saw with raloxifene was that when we looked at serious thromboembolic events, deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary emboli, there were 30% fewer thrombotic events with raloxifene as compared with tamoxifen. There were also fewer cataracts. The number of fracture events was about the same, and both tamoxifen and raloxifene are known to reduce fractures compared to placebo. The number of cardiac events was the same. And so overall, when we looked at the data in total, it appeared to us that the benefit in terms of reducing the risk of invasive cancer was the same for both drugs, but there was a substantial improvement in toxicity, both for uterine events and for thromboembolic events with raloxifene compared to tamoxifen.
So if a patient were to say to you, if I take raloxifene, is that going to increase my risk of endometrial cancer or deep vein thrombosis, how would you respond?
So the answer to the endometrial cancer is that no, there is no apparent increased risk of uterine events with raloxifene. For clotting events, the risk will be increased with raloxifene, but the amount of increase will be substantially less than what we would expect to see with tamoxifen.
And so I guess in saying that you don't think there's an increased risk with endometrial cancer, you're sort of indirectly trying to compare to the placebo.
Yes, and one of the criticisms that has been leveled at the START trial is that there was no placebo arm, but for the reasons I explained, we didn't think it was ethical to conduct a trial with a placebo. And so we're left with inferences between the two treatment arms in STAR and the placebo arms in other trials. But when you put all those data together, it doesn't appear that there's a uterine effect with raloxifene.
You know, one of the things that's been interesting since the P1 study came out is kind of the relative lack of use of tamoxifen for prevention in general as it sort of played out in clinical practice. I'm curious about your own practice in that regard. To what extent have you been using tamoxifen, and what are you doing right now in terms of raloxifene?
We have a high-risk clinic where we get referrals from our surgical colleagues and from the mammography screening program, and we see about 500 to 600 patients a year who have either lobular carcinoma in situ or atypical hyperplasia, or who have family histories and have Gale model risk scores that would put them at increased risk. And for those women, particularly who have atypia and LCIS, but also for those with Gale scores over 2% risk in 5 years, we recommend tamoxifen to those women. I've been a little bit surprised, but my experience is consistent with the published literature that the uptake of tamoxifen is not great. There is reluctance, even among high-risk women, to take tamoxifen because of the concerns about both uterine malignancy and thrombosis. Now, I think some of those data have been misinterpreted. If you look at the data from the P1 trial particularly, but from the entire NSABP experience with tamoxifen in several trials, there is no increased risk of thromboembolic events in women under 50 with tamoxifen, and there is no increased risk of uterine events among premenopausal women who take tamoxifen. So for many of our high-risk women who are under 50, and that's a large proportion, well more than half of the patients we see, we counsel them that if they're post-childbearing age, if they're 40 or older, they're still menstruating, and they have increased risk of developing breast cancer, that we believe they can safely receive tamoxifen and not be at increased risk based on the data of either thromboembolic events or uterine events. Now, for women who are postmenopausal, it's a little more challenging. And what we've found, and we've published these observations, is that for women who have lobular carcinoma in situ or atypical hyperplasia, where the breast cancer risk is very large, then the risk-benefit ratio of taking tamoxifen is tilted in the favor of net benefit, and more of those women with atypia or LCIS will elect to take tamoxifen. But still, there are those in those high-risk categories who simply will not take tamoxifen because of the known side effects, and particularly as their age approaches 60 and over, then even we counsel them that there may be no net benefit when you figure in the thrombotic events and the uterine malignancies.
I guess we should reemphasize that the STAR trial was done just in postmenopausal women, but in postmenopausal women right now outside of a protocol setting, are you generally recommending raloxifene over tamoxifen?
We're telling patients that we believe it's best to put that on hold. Even though I was the protocol chairman of the STAR trial and I believe the results, I think it's appropriate to wait until the Food and Drug Administration approves raloxifene for this indication. Now, not infrequently, we'll see postmenopausal women who happen to have DEXA scans that show that they're candidates for raloxifene for management of their osteoporosis. And if they have indications for osteoporosis, we'll give them raloxifene and explain that they'll also derive a benefit in terms of their breast cancer. We tell patients that we anticipate the FDA will approve raloxifene for breast cancer risk reduction in the next 6 to 12 months, and we're asking those patients simply to wait until that approval comes before we begin to prescribe raloxifene. But my impression, although this will have to be confirmed with practice in the future, my impression is that a large number of those patients who are candidates for raloxifene therapy will elect raloxifene therapy based on the STAR trial results when the FDA approves it for that indication.
We've been talking about the use of long-term hormonal therapy today, both in terms of the treatment as well as prevention setting. And that brings in the issue of adherence to taking the therapy. And you were part of really a fascinating project that was presented at the ASCO meeting on that. I wonder if you could comment on that.
We worked with Brad Davidson, who's a linguist, not someone that medical oncologists work with on a routine basis. And he's from a company called MBS Vox that actually studies interactions between doctors and patients. And he did a fascinating study where he actually audiotaped and videotaped encounters between 28 oncologists and their patients who were postmenopausal and taking aromatase inhibitor therapy. And he looked to see whether on those return visits for patients who were on AI therapy, whether the oncologist was asking them about their adherence to the prescribed regimen. And adherence is interesting. It's a combination of compliance, that is the patient taking the medicine as prescribed, one pill a day, and persistence, that is, are they taking it over a long period of time? And so you put compliance and persistence together and you get adherence. Well, it was very distressing to see the results that Dr. Davidson found in that in virtually no encounter between oncologists and patients taking aromatase inhibitors, were there any targeted questions about persistence or adherence to the regimen? And there are published data that show that the decay over time in terms of patients coming off drugs is very, very high. There's more data published with tamoxifen than with AIs, but there are even some AI data that say as many as a third of the patients stopped the AIs within the first year, and by the second year, as many as half the patients have stopped taking their aromatase inhibitor. This should be distressing to all of us because it's obvious and probably trite to say, but the medication does no benefit if it's in the bottle and not in the patient. And I think we need to be aware, and I hope Dr. Davidson's study makes us all aware, that in fact, we as oncologists aren't doing a good job of asking patients whether they're taking the medicines as prescribed and are not helping patients overcome barriers. There's a number of barriers. The cost is a barrier. The side effects that we discussed, like arthralgias and myalgias, can be a barrier. But I think equally important is the misperception of the patients that if time has transpired and they're doing well, they're coming back for their second and third annual visits, their mammograms are fine, their physical exams are fine, they're having no symptoms. There is this unfortunate false belief among patients that if I'm feeling well and my exams are fine, that all the risk has passed. And therefore, it's not necessary for me to continue to take these medications. And I think what we've tried to emphasize in these studies, in our conclusions, is that it's important for oncologists, first of all, to be aware that patients are stopping their medications, that obviously they can derive no benefit if the medications have been discontinued, and that we need to regularly ask patients about whether they're taking the medications daily and whether there are any barriers to doing that, be they cost or symptoms or perceptions about the risk of recurrence. And I think this is something that we're going to need to educate ourselves about, because until these data became known, I don't think it was well recognized in our treatment communities that patients were stopping their medications.
I guess this whole clinical approach in terms of trying to ask patients, et cetera, is something that has become a big part of primary care.
Yes, and in fact, there are published studies showing that for chronic conditions like hypertension and dyslipidemia and compliance with diabetes management regimens, that these issues about adherence and persistence and compliance are important there too. And as a clinician, you would think that if a person had a serious disease like a previous myocardial infarction or coronary artery bypass surgery or breast cancer, that when a medication was prescribed for the purpose of preventing a recurrence, that there would be uniform compliance. But in fact, across diseases, and this includes taking therapy for HIV disease, even in the organ transplant setting, there are data that say that patients stop taking the medications to prevent rejection. And there are data with imatinib among people with chronic myelogenous leukemia that say those patients stopped their medications. So there's a wide spectrum of data that says this is a large problem across a number of chronic diseases, and we need to be more attentive to the fact that patients are discontinuing medications that provide great benefit, and we need to explore mechanisms to help patients to continue on these beneficial regimens.
You know, it's interesting. We've done surveys of physicians, we've done surveys of nurses, and we've done surveys actually of breast cancer patients asking, to what extent is this a problem? And all three groups say it is not a problem. Yes, the physicians, the patients say they've taken their medication. People aren't even interested in this, really, because they feel it's not a problem. What's the disparity between that perception and these data?
Well, these data suggest that perception is entirely wrong, that we're not in tune to the reality that when you actually look at things like prescription refills and availability of medications over time, that in fact patients are not being compliant. And I think the first step here is for us to recognize that they aren't persistent, they aren't adherent in these regimens, and to stop pretending that they're simply following our directions because we told them this is what they need to do. We need to ascertain with many strategies, be it pill counts or simply asking patients or with pharmacy records. We need to constantly assure that what we believe the patient is doing is what they're actually doing. And the data would suggest that, in fact, patients are not following our advice. And so more work needs to be done in this regard.